You know who I am and who Annie is. We were here, how long ago were we here, Tom? 18 months, 2 years ago? Before we went to Mozambique, anyway, we had a really great opportunity to come over here and share with you about our forthcoming time in Mozambique. So what you're getting today is like the after. You've had the before, so now you're getting the after. And what I wanted just to try and show you this morning, if the technology is on our side, which is highly unlikely, I would imagine, but if it were on our side, we're going to try and show you a little bit of a DVD, which tells you the story of how the work in Mozambique started. While I'm just waiting for that to try and do its thing, let me just show you some different things that we've got here. There's some of them available for sale here to support the work in Angosh, over in that basket in there. There's a 10-minute version and a 20-minute version. We'll probably try and show you a clip of it if we can. But it tells you the story of how God touched a completely isolated and rejected folk Islamic community and brought transformation to that group of people behind the back of Beyond. It's one of the most difficult places that in the world to get to. Another thing to show you, we've got some free copies of a magazine called Nations. Where we were working with an outfit called World Outreach into that community, and I wrote an article for their sort of magazine, a little bit about what, why we were doing what we were doing, really, I suppose. So do take a copy of that. There's some other issues of the magazine there as well, so do just take whatever one you fancy. And in most of them, there are articles about the Koti and about Mozambique. And they're great articles. I haven't written them, so they're quite good. So there's that. So do help yourself with that. And finishing my little pitch, really. If you look at the New Testament, you'll discover that Jesus commanded us to do a number of different things. Can anybody give me an idea of one or two of those things? Yes, go to the world. Anything else? Love one another. Make disciples. Love God. Pray. Forgive. Be filled with the Holy Spirit. Anything else? Heal the sick. So a number of different commands he gave us. And the basis of the teaching and what we did in Mozambique was to look at 10 of the key commands of Jesus and unpack and explore those with the community there to find out what those actually meant and try and put them into practice. And off the back of that, a discipleship manual was written that sort of follows along that whole discipleship model of sharing with people what those commands are. And this is the English version of it. It's not in Portuguese. So now precisa falar português, precisa falar English. So you need to speak English to do this one, not Portuguese. So it's a really cool book. If there's somebody that you know of who's recently become a Christian, it's a brilliant course, like a 10-week thing to take them through. And there's a coach's part in the back, so, and a disciple's part in the front. And it's designed for people who are new Christians, and also it's designed for people who are new Christians to do it with other new Christians. So you don't have to be a vintage person like me. You can be new in your faith, and it's a great tool for sharing it. And we use that reproductive model of teaching people how to share and disciple one another and then send them off and get them to do it. So to give you the, probably the best thing I can do is just to tell you the story, if that's all right. Back in 1994, you'll recall there was lots of interest in something called the Toronto Blessing. And there was a great outpouring of the Holy Spirit in many nations and many places around the world. And some people were a little critical about the fact that to them it appeared that all it was about people getting blessed and rolling around on the floor and giggling or whatever else it was. But was it really meaningful? Was it really sustainable? Was it lasting? What was really happening with this? Was it just a one-off show or what? round about that time, some of the guys who'd been involved in that really had a sense that God was wanting to say, we need to pray for the nations. We need to pray for the nations. We need to pray for the nations and see God break out and do something in the context of people who have never had an opportunity to hear about Jesus. So that was birthed, a fresh sort of wave of that was birthed out of 1994 and the Toronto Blessing. And a Japanese guy who was passionate about mission went to Africa, and he went to Mozambique, and I'm going to get the map just to show you. There's a whole load of things here you can have a look at afterwards. So I suggest, my beautiful assistant is going to hold it for me. Come up here, Annie, you can't hide over there. Hold on. So this is Mozambique. Behind Mozambique is Annie, as always. So capital in the bottom, South Africa down here, Kruger Park. So just there's where the football's going on, if you're interested. And right the way up here is a place called Angosh. Angosh was a centre for the slave trade, and slavery was going on through that town up until 1966. So it shows you how recent that history is. And off Angosh there's a whole load of islands. So thanks, Annie. I'm sure your arms are aching now. Well done, beautiful. Much nicer looking at Annie than the map. So in those islands, there's a group of people, and this guy decided to take a small team of people with him, this Japanese man, a New Zealander, and some others, and go and explore and get some data about what was going on. So they found the chief of the Koti community on the mainland, and asked him about the islands. And he said, oh, well, there's 13 different islands, and these are the different people who are on those islands, and told them all about them. So they got in an Arab dhow, which is a simple timber boat with a sail made out of grain bags, and they sailed off towards these islands. And they had a particular place that they were sort of aiming for. You know, like when you sail, you have to have somewhere in mind to go for, don't you? Don't just do aimlessly. So they were aiming for one place, and a storm came up, and the Angosh Channel is quite a dangerous place. A number of people drown quite regularly in that channel. The local fishermen often drown. Oh, there we go, there's a bit of it. So they sail across, and the storm blows up, and they're basically sort of shipwrecked onto the island. So they're shipwrecked onto the island, and they're soaking wet, so they light a fire, and they start running up and down the beach to dry themselves off. And the people come out from their huts, from underneath the coconut palms, and say, well, who are you, and where are you from? You know, what are you doing here? And they say, and note this wording, because this wording is quite important. They say, we're followers of Jesus, and we've come to tell you more about God. And the islanders, they didn't introduce themselves as Christians, right? They didn't say, here we are Christians. Because if you say that to an Islamic, folk Islamic guy, they'll probably tell you to go somewhere. Not very pleasant. So the guy on the island said, well, obviously, God's brought you here, so you ought to stay here, and you need to tell us. And they had a guitar with them. They had some a picture book with some flashcards and Bible stories, and they started to worship and tell them these stories as it got dark, shining a light onto the flashcard. And out of that evening, those guys on that island of Buzu, which wasn't on the man's list. You know, I told you the chief said there's these 13 islands. He didn't put that one on the list because they didn't like the people of Buzu, and it was a small and forgotten island. They were quite an aggressive bunch of people, and they weren't popular generally amongst the other Koti, so he'd ignored them off his list. And those people became followers of Jesus. That was in around about 1999, 2000. As of today, those guys form the real core of 140 different, we call them families of faith, not churches, because church again has a poor connotation in an Islamic context, so we call them families of faith. There's 140 or more of those dotted all around the region amongst a community of 65,000 people. There are now between 5 and 6,000 followers of Jesus. And as a consequence of what has happened, lives have been transformed. And we'll tell you a bit more when we do our PowerPoint a bit later. But that's the context, really, that I wanted just to set for you. That's the story that that we arrived in. Why don't we just show you just a couple of minutes of this video, just to give you a glimpse, if we can. All right, we're going to keep it deep and crisp and even. You know, like the, what was that? A Christmas carol, isn't it? Deep and crisp and even. Do you believe that? If you believe me, then you really are lost. Right, what we want to do is to... we want to tell the story, really, of the friends and the people that we connected with while we're in Mozambique, because to us one of the most important things is that their story is heard, and that you have a chance to get to know what they're like and who they are and what they're about. We got sent out by you guys to go and befriend these people and serve them, and so we'd like you to know them. If you want to know them better than what we're able to communicate here, then you can always come with us when we go in September and say hi to them in Portuguese, and we'll teach you how to do that. So, but let's try this PowerPoint, shall we? See how we do with technology part two. And Annie's going to talk us through some stuff.
Okay. So, yeah, you recognise Julian. The other guy is Asani, and he basically helped us in the house. So he did lots of practical stuff. He operated our twin tub washing machine, and he did cleaning and stuff like that. But he was just an amazing guy, and he was our friend, really, which was probably the most precious thing for us. And he just helped us in so many ways to be at home and to know how things work and how what you do. And we had a constant stream of people coming to the door, because as we were white people, they just presumed that we had money and lots of money to give away. And they were in desperate need, and we could totally understand why they were coming. But it was quite a challenge to constantly have this draw on you, as to them expecting you to be the answer to their problems. But Asani really helped us in that, and that was great.
So the person standing next to Asani is Inacio. If we could go to the next click there. That's lovely. Now, I mentioned that the church comprised about 5,000 people, didn't I? And there was one English speaker amongst that 5,000 people, and that was Inacio. So before we went to Mozambique, we spent 11 weeks learning Portuguese, and then off we went, speaking, preaching, sharing, organising things on the house, doing all that we could do with our pidgin Portuguese. And so he was an immense help to us, having somebody there who could speak English and who could fill in the gaps of our appalling vocabulary and unconjugated verbs. He was one of the core leaders. He'd come from the middle of the country, effectively as a missionary, to come and work with the Koti people, the Mozambican, but from a different tribe. He and I were the only car drivers as well, and I'll come on to that in a moment in terms of what that meant. If we could do another click. How you guys helped, River helped, provide him with a home. He was a key worker really, as far as the work in Mozambique and in Angosh was concerned. And with a few £100s, we were able to help build a really cool home for him, which gave him a sense of security. He'd been moving around from rented place to rented place to rented place, not being able to stay anywhere with his family. And so providing him a base and something to keep him there was really, really important. Okay, if we go to the next click. Are you going to talk about... Yeah, or am I? Paya Lima. Okay, Paya Lima is... You saw him on that little video presentation, didn't you? You may have recognised him. That's all of his children. If we do another click. Lovely. He is an amazing... He's about that high. He's really, really short, but he's a real firecracker. And great teacher. Amazing evangelist. On the island of Buzu, I told you that the church community started there amongst those islanders, and 3 years later the island was washed away due to, you'll be aware of the whole coastal erosion and rising sea levels with climate change. The island was completely washed away and lost, and the guys from the island felt that God was saying to them they needed to go to different places and not just stay on their island and take the gospel and the good news to different places. So the government had given them some money to relocate to one place, but Paya Lima said, no, I don't think I want to go there. I think God's sending me to another island called Kelaleni, which is a 3-hour boat ride from the main town. And he's planted a group of churches there. Completely indigenously done, without any support from some white geezer like me, just doing the stuff himself, discipling people using the materials that we're doing, and then he's now going to move from Kelaleni, let them do their thing, and he's going to do it again somewhere else. So it's a very much a reproductive, self-reproducing model without outside, loads of outside direction and influence. So that's him. You talk about this, Annie.
The children. I mean, we're so often in the West bombarded with pictures of African children in need. In a sense, there's nothing to say to this picture. These were just some guys that we know that God loved as much as he loves our kids here. And yeah, they were amazing. Always smiles on their faces despite the hardship of life. And with the money that you guys sent out for the famine fund, we were able to help them a bit. So thank you, because they're not able to be here to thank you, but they would do. Thank you all very much.
And they would say that they'd say Kasha Karela, in which in Koti means thank you, or if they use Portuguese they'd say obrigado. You bought about 700 bags of grain with the money that you sent, which goes, and the government was supposed to have done something to help relieve the famine, but were completely disorganized and corrupt, and nothing arrived from the main city. So what we did was the only thing that was done to help that community. So, and it was, there's people walking the streets now of Angosh who wouldn't be walking those streets if it wasn't for the money that you guys sent. So that's why we say thank you. You talk about these mums then, Annie.
Yeah, these were people that we, again, got to know and love. They often turned up on our door saying, we haven't got enough food, we've had to go to the hospital, take our children there, and they prescribed some medicine, but we haven't got any money for it. And but one of the projects that we worked on was the Mashamba, and representatives of 30 families were able to go up there and plant seed, do the thing, and eventually had a harvest from it. But you can see them. I mean, they're not fat people, are they? They are so skinny, and yet they're quite sort of tough and hardy. And they were our friends, and we love them, and we miss them.
Annie had a nickname for one of them who was particularly thin. She used to call them Stick Lady. So, and they were very. We were in Lesotho from 94 to 96, and our image of an African lady was a very, very traditionally built woman. If you'd seen Number One Ladies Detective Agency and the descriptions of large African ladies, so it was quite a shock to us to see how thin and undernourished these ladies were. Let's move on to the next one. One of the other things that I was doing was teaching English. So every week I'd run a teaching class, and these are some of the lads from the teaching class. And these guys led the town church. So there was a church that met every Sunday in the main city, and these four boys, who are between the ages of 18 and 20, were the ones who led that. And I didn't go along and speak when I was there. I went along and learnt and enjoyed worshipping with them, dancing with them. And then once in a while they would say, oh, could you do something? So then we'd do a drama around one of the parables, maybe like the Good Samaritan or something, get everybody involved and all the kids in doing it. But they were doing it all themselves. It's quite something. I know. Well, what happened was, I know, it's, I'm a bit really shocked by that as well. What we did was, we said, these guys love football. That, like, football is their passion. And so we said to some people in River, could you send us some football shirts, please? And we didn't specify which team. So a whole load of football shirts got brought out by somebody, and we pulled them out and put them on the porch and said, okay, boys, which ones do you want? And they fell upon the Chelsea ones. So there you go. There were some Liverpool supporters there and Manchester United supporters, but nobody supported Tottenham, my team. I think they'd even heard of them. So, but they were astonishingly courageous, dynamic young men. The guy on the second in from the left called Alito, when he was with us, he suffered from malaria, and he came very close, I think, to dying from it. And he's like a younger lad, and you sort of think, well, they'd be okay, but they're just so undernourished and so weak and have suffered it for so many times. They're weak, you know. Yeah, I really, really miss them, and you made it possible for me to call their friends, and they just come and share their problems, sit on our porch and just talk with us and be with us. Next slide. In Angosh, one of the challenges was getting your hair cut. And I got my hair cut by the lovely Giselle, as you can see there, in what used to be a traditional Portuguese barber's. It was occupied by the Portuguese until 1975. And Giselle decided that she could cut my hair for me with the bluntest pair of drapery scissors that you have ever seen, which were slightly sort of rusty and stained. And she actually managed to cut my ear in the process, but obviously was practiced at doing that because he had some Savlon orange antiseptic and cotton wool to dab on it to make it better. And those sort of troughs through the back of my hair is how she left it, which my hair looked fine when I was wearing a cap. So, and then I got my hair repaired by some American, two American girls who were Peace Corps workers in the town, and one of them said, oh, I've cut my brother's hair, I can sort yours out for me. And she started to do it for me, and guess what she did? She cut my ear as well. So I'm very, very twitchy now about anybody going near my ears with a pair of scissors. So that's Giselle. It'll probably be you next, won't it? Yeah, let's give the next one.
Excellent.
Yeah. No, okay. Tariki Ahaki, that means the true way. So that's what we called it, and it's very much based upon the New Testament. That's how the work was called that Jesus left behind. He called it the Way, so we called it the True Way. 5,000 followers of Jesus, 140 families of faith, 40 attending weekly training. So I would help with that weekly training. For the first time ever, we got them doing workshops. So rather than somebody standing and then preaching at them, we were using... I'll just get this... We were using, number one, this is a Cotty Bible. So in the year 2000, those people couldn't read. They couldn't read their own language because their own language had never been written before. And now they're reading a book in their own language. Yeah, and they're studying it for themselves. So we would ask, do like little work groups with the leaders. Open up, this is Genesis, Luke, 2 Timothy and Jonah. And so I've written workshop materials for all of those. And so we went through the whole book of Luke with them. Every week, little groups sitting down together with their Kotti scriptures, asking questions and then going around and finding the answers together. And then at the end of the session, feedback from each group. So what was your answer to question one? Question two, did you get the same answer? And they loved it. And they absorbed it, you know, rather than, like, I don't know about you, but I've been in church a very, 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 very long time, and I've sat in many, many sermons, most of which I can't remember. So, but if I've actually had to do some work, then I've remembered it. So, a very effective way of doing it, and these guys then would go out each week, reusing what we taught them, and going into their churches, their 140 different churches. They would then train their leaders in those 140 churches, and those guys would then go out into the villages and do the same material with those people dotted around every week, week on, week out, week on, week on. So quite a good way of reproducing stuff. Okay, next one.
Who did the translation?
Yes, Wycliffe did the original translation. Yeah.
So this is Silva in the middle, and as it says, Silva was, is this working?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
Sorry. 14 years old, had a really difficult background in terms of his family life, and as it says up there, his sister was opposed to the church, to his faith. So when we first arrived, he was living on an island with his sister, and his sister said, if you go to Tarikia Haki, I will not feed you. So he wasn't very involved, as you can imagine, with the church, but he needed to go on to secondary education, which is on the mainland. But he had no way of that transportation from the island to the mainland. So he was waiting for us or somebody to arrange him a home. And he used to turn up on our doorstep more or less every day for the first, I don't know how long, month probably, saying, have you sorted something out for me? Because he was so desperate for his secondary education. We were beginning to pull our hair out, but eventually he managed to arrange for him to go and live with Asani, who was the guy in the first picture who helped us in the house. And the transformation over the year that we were there was just absolutely amazing. He moved in with Asani. Asani just took him on as one of his children, and he was getting love from Asani. He was part of the family of faith, and he got his education and a Chelsea t-shirt again, I'm afraid.
Okay, another click. There we go, and that's his first day at secondary school, wearing his new uniform and his second-hand shoes that we bought in the market for him. So, yeah, next click. Okay, and again. So we did a number of different projects. One of them was, as we mentioned, the Mashamba, which is the agricultural project, mobilising 30 families from 6 different villages to go and grow food for themselves so they could support themselves. First time ever that they're able to do that in that context. If we go to the next one. We also helped to buy fishing nets and put money towards fishing boats so that they could get out there and support themselves fishing. I put little contracts in place, so I wrote little documents in Portuguese which sort of made the agreement between the fishermen and Tarikia Haki to say, this is what the fisherman's got to do, this is what the Tarikia Haki will do, etc. So I gave some structure to it, which really helped when they came against, you know, problems and complaints. We'd just pull out the document and say, well, that's what you agreed to, you know. Oh, right, okay, good, yes, I did, didn't I? Fine. So, but it was good to see them supporting themselves as much as possible. Next slide. Church planting. The guys, as we've alluded to in the film there, the Mawani are another coastal folk Islamic people group, speak a different language again, but also speak Portuguese as the second language, about 8 hours drive up the coast in that little baki, we call it like a pickup thing. We sent the guys out and we're going to be church planting and sending some of the people that you saw on that video up to what we call Mawani land. It's not really called that, but we just call it Mawani land because that's where the Mawani are. And we'll do the same thing again. They'll start church planting, evangelizing. And because they are folk Islamic and not white Christians, they'll be accepted. Rather than if I went there, I'd be kicked out. They wouldn't listen to me. They said, we don't want you here. You know, you're a Christian. And when these guys arrived, they'd be asked the question, are you Christians? And they would say, we are followers of Isa. We're followers of Jesus. And we're Jesus Muslims. That's the other phrase that we use. So they just, they haven't lost their cultural identity, but they're passionate followers of God. Next slide. Yeah. Again. So, like I said, we did the English lessons, and you'll see up on the board there, in that display area on the right-hand side, there's a board with some stories about these widows. Did you hear, I don't know if you just caught it on the video, the lady said that we don't like to just start orphanages and do that stuff. What we prefer to do, actually, is to give people money in the community who can then be able to support and foster and adopt these abandoned children. Much better, because it keeps them in family, they're not put in some institution, and then they're supported amongst the community rather than by some white person running some thing. So that's the strategy, that's the philosophy in terms of what we do. And we visited that village and interviewed these different mums, and it was one of my best days ever, going around from house to house, sitting with these mothers. Some of them maybe had one husband who died in a fishing accident, next husband had died from malaria, and now they were on their own. They're looking after 8 kids, walking 2 kilometres to get water. Very, very tough lives. We were giving them $5 or $6 a month, and that would make an enormous difference to their well-being and being able to look after these kids and do what they were doing. And so I'd ask him questions like, what do you like cooking then, and what's your favourite food, and what's it like? Some great stories up there. It wasn't all unpleasant. That's our beach, Praia Nova, that we used to walk along if we wanted a break and go somewhere nice. So the Indian Ocean is a beautiful place. And Giovanni is an island where I want to try and get some wells sunk because they've got no water on the island. 250 people live there, no water, 20 of litres of water a day between the 250 people on the island, and that water is brackish water. So I want to get a proper well sunk if we can. That's one of my projects on my list.
And there's no water there, but I was able to get my emails on my mobile phone sitting there. So that just shows you the craziness of our technology and lives. No water, but you can get your emails.
Okay. And next. Where to live? Our house on the left, an old Portuguese house which was owned by the Catholic Church, which was really ramshackle, and we did it up. Casa de Machamba means, Machamba is an agricultural plot, Casa means house, of course, so it's an agricultural house. Those little houses cost about £150 each and would last about 10 to 15 years. So we ran a project building houses for those people who had houses destroyed in the storms and the like. And so like £200, you could build a decent house for somebody and their family when they had nothing. So moving on.
I guess you probably noticed at the beginning of the DVD there's a lot of talk about how much prayer has gone into. But prayer for me was one of the things that I felt I could do and help with when we were out there. So I used to go out every morning and pray and walk around, and that was great. But there was a lot of prayer going on, so one day some of the ladies just decided, instead of having a meeting, they would come and pray in the different houses of the people who were part of the community of faith, and that was myself, you can see there with them, just praying on our porch. And there's the mosque. I think one of the things that's most liberating for the guys out there is this realisation that you're not restricted to praying in a building, but that you can pray wherever you are. And it's probably something that we take for granted, but with their Islamic background, you know, they had so many rules and regulations as to what they could and couldn't do, and praying is just something that they've been totally liberated in, to be able to pray anywhere and everywhere.
Cool. So let's have the next one. Now let's give you some food for thought. Let's just hold it there. Okay. So on the left you'll see a storehouse. Now when we had the famine, February in 2009, we put out an appeal based upon the fact that it was a Wycliffe lady who was 25 years old, who ran their finances at Wycliffe in the main city, 4 hours drive away, and she'd set aside $1,000 and had been saving and saving and saving for the Cotty people, but didn't quite know how to get it to them. And we were up there for our monthly, so drive there to do our monthly shop, to go to the supermarket. The supermarket was 4 hours drive away on a track, so we drive there, do our shopping, go and see them. And she said, I've got this money and I'm wondering, because you're down there, maybe you could use this, what do you think? And I grabbed it, you know, and said, Alison, that's just brilliant, you know, yeah, we will, and we'll buy a whole load of grain. And that inspired us really to think, right, okay, well, let's get some more money. So we sent out an email to 200 nearly 300 different people, and within 10 days had raised £12,000, which meant that we could go and buy all that grain on the left-hand side in that warehouse. And I had one of my best days. If you say what are your best days and worst days in Angosh, best day driving the baccy to deliver some of that grain to a little village. Fab. If you want to do something wonderful, then that's a wonderful opportunity, so thank you for letting me do that. Worst day, standing at the leaders' meeting when the first leader stood up and said, this week, six of my guys died due to cholera. Next leader stood up and said, yeah, my village, same thing, but it's 10 guys. Next guy stands up, my village, same problems. Next week they stand up and say, oh, now the police are attacking us, we can't stay in our houses at night, we've got to sleep in the bush because there was fighting about all the cholera and blame being attributed to different people, so the police started to kill them, so they hid in the bush and then came back out again. And after they'd been sharing each time, the main leader would then turn around to me and say, Julian, is there anything you'd like to say? Not an easy context to be in, so it put for me into context all the leaders' meetings that I've been in River over the years, and thought, hey, you know, this is just a whole different league, really. But God really met them and gave me the words to find to encourage and love them and support them and know that we were standing with them. And that was the main thing that we were able to do. We were able to be there with them and be there for them. It wasn't all the things which we did, it was the fact that we were who we were and we were there with them. So that's the grain on the left. Romans 5. I think we're living in amazing privilege. And so Romans 5 talks about, because of what Jesus Christ has done for us, because of our faith, Christ has brought us to a place of undeserved privilege. And I think we do have that. You know, when having been in Angosh and lived amongst those people, it's the hardest place in the world that I've lived in or visited. And I know that standing in Slough or Maidenhead or Marlow, we live in amazing privilege. And sometimes we may think, oh, well, you know, it's a credit crunch and it's tough times and all the rest of it. But, you know, compared to these guys, we live with amazing privilege. So my question, which I just want to leave us all with this morning, really, is what should we do with the privilege we have? What do we do with all that blessing and goodness that God's given us, the wealth, the health, the access to all the different things which we have, the knowledge, the intellect, the education that we have? What choices are we just using that for ourselves and for our own well-being and for our own futures? Or are we using the privilege that we've received and the blessing that we've received to go and serve others? And Annie and I would say, if you just keep it to yourself, you're really, really missing out. You're really missing out, because the joy of being able to live with people like that. And if somebody said to me, did you like being there? I would say, no, I didn't. Are you glad that you went there? Yes, I am. Would you go there again? Yeah, if God told me to. And that's just what I want to leave you with this morning. Just try and tune into what God has got for you and think about what he's blessed you with. And maybe this week, have a think about, hey, what could I do? Can I just be there with somebody who needs an arm putting around them this week? And I may be a bit embarrassed, but I'm just going to show them the love of God. Or maybe I can just send some money somewhere for something. Or maybe I can just take some time out and pray for somebody else rather than my own predicament this week. But pray for somebody else. What are the things that you could do that are just outside of your zone and outside of your box this week? Thank you so much for your support, your love, your finances, your prayers. That made it possible for us to do what we're able to do. So cheers.